On last week's The Space Show, we were at the European Geosciences Union in Vienna, Austria, and there was a session held there about the very latest from Rosetta. We now go to the question and answer session from that conference.
And we'll start with Matthew Taylor, who is the Rosetta Project Scientist at the European Space Agency, or ESA. Then we'll have Hans Ulrich Auster, who is the principal investigator for ROMAP, the Rosetta magnetometer and plasma monitor on board Philae, and he's at the Technische Universität Braunschweig in Germany. Then we'll follow with Karl-Heinz Glasmeier, who is the principal investigator of the RPC-MAG, the Fluxgate magnetometer in the Rosetta Plasma Consortium, and he's also at the same university in Germany. And then we'll have Stefan Ulamek, who is the Philae project manager, and he's based at the DLR, the German Aerospace Center. We'll now open the floor for questions.
Marie Leroux from AFP. I have a few questions about Philae, please. I would like to know how long it's going to remain in listening mode this time around. How long? And if this doesn't work again, when will the next attempt be? And the other question is, if you could please just explain to me the attitude. I'm sorry, I didn't quite understand from the slide.
Yeah, okay. So at the moment, we have switched on the receiver units on the orbiter, and we may consider to simply keep it on, so stay in a listening mode. So whenever the lander is woken up and the geometry is in a way that there is RF link possible, we switch it at a... We will hear it immediately. Now, you know, there was these problems with the star trackers. Rosetta is now on a slightly different orbiter as originally planned. This is, by the way, not so bad for the lander because we more or less stay now in the area where there is also sun illumination. So we may just stay in a listening mode and wait. The other point was regarding the attitude. Now, this is the attitude relative to the comet, and we know it from the ROMAP measurement. So ROMAP is a compass, so we know this attitude. What we do not know is the exactly position, where now exactly on the comet the lander is in this attitude. But we do know where the antenna pattern is showing. So in this sense, it is useful, but it doesn't give us the real context of the rocks, the walls, the material around.
Of nature. Dr. Glasmeier, could you perhaps explain why scientists had thought that a body as small as that comet might have a magnetic field? I understand magnetic fields arise from the geodynamos in large objects like Earth or moons. But why should a relatively small object have a magnetic field?
Well, it's a good question. We know from the Earth that there are at least three contributions to the magnetic field we see and can measure at the Earth's surface. The major one comes from so-called dynamo processes in the outer core of the Earth. And we are pretty sure that such a process cannot happen in a small body like a comet. But at the Earth's surface, in the Earth's crust, we also know about magnetized regions where we have iron, little magnets which are oriented by the main magnetic field or also have been oriented into put into orientation into what we now call remnant magnetization. We know that the Earth's magnetic field has changed over the past billion years. And if you take a lava flow with lots of iron or magnetized material in it, then because it's fluid and heated up, you can start to orient these little magnetized dust particles in such a lava flow. And if the lava flow cools, you are blocking and you are conserving the magnetization. This is what we call remnant magnetization. And a similar process may happen in the early solar system. We know that comets also contain iron, and iron is one of these elements where you can expect magnetic properties. And there are also theoretical ideas that in the very early solar system, magnetic fields played a major role for transporting angular momentum within the forming planetary system. And these magnetic fields might then be able to orient the small dust particles now part of the comet. And if you have orientation of small dust, magnetized dust particles into larger regimes, they should form also remnant magnetization. And this was the idea that we said, okay, we know there cannot be a dynamo operating, but we might have a chance to measure remnant magnetization. And if we would have measured remnant magnetization, it would give us information about the magnetic field strength in the early solar system. Now, the fact that we see such a very small magnetization of the cometary material, it also allows to enter this idea about the importance of the magnetic fields in the early solar system. And I think we have to restart the discussion in that direction again, because we feel that the fields have been much smaller in the early solar system than previously thought. Because if they would have been larger, then we most probably would have seen a more strong magnetization. And that is the scientific background and the interest we have in doing these measurements. But they need to be in a very decent and precise way.
I have a question. Two from online, but they're kind of similar. So I have Hamish Johnson from Physics World that was wondering, if magnetic forces are not involved in the comet formation, you kind of answered this, but then how does that change the model for how comets were formed? And then Jacob Aaron from New Scientist was wondering, if magnetic forces were not involved in the clumping together of planetary building blocks, then which forces were responsible?
So it doesn't change the models, but it excludes one part of one of the models for the planetary formation. So if the magnetic forces are not able to align and at least to accumulate larger particles as we had it measured in the meter scale, we cannot say anything about centimeter scales, but for larger granulation like meter, we can be sure that at least if this comet is representative for the others, then there's no chance that you can have an accretion on with magnetic forces. So simply this magnetic accretion model for larger scales can be now excluded. That's the answer for what has changed for the models.
What are the alternative explanations?
Oh, there are some. So I'm probably not the expert for answering that question, but there are some alternative models. For instance, like if you have one part, one lucky winner part, which is already a little bit larger than the other ones, and if this one collides with other smaller particles, then a little bit remains on this larger part, and this leads to a growing process for this only one. So the others will be destroyed at least, but this only one, larger one, can grow up to higher dimension, up to meter and larger scales. And then, of course, if you are in the order of few tenths of meters, then the gravitation becomes an important force for that. There's another theory. It's like at the Tour de France, for instance. If you're one leading guy and the others are in the shadow, you have similar situation in the gas track and the preplanetary disk. So the other particles can be accelerated behind this leading part, and then of course the relative velocity between this and the other parts becomes lower, and then again accretion could theoretically happen, and then van der Waals forces are still enough to keep all the things together. So that's maybe the two other models I know. Probably there are some others as well.
Jonathan Amos, BBC News. I mean, but it's smaller scales than a meter. I mean, we see dust grains routinely in the galaxy and the solar system aligning with magnetic fields. So couldn't these processes begin on those scales? I mean, I'm talking on particle scales of dust. And then some of these other forces come into play at a later stage. Yeah?
We cannot exclude that for smaller scales, of course. It's still...
I think the scale we can do measurements on is about 1 meter, which is about the distance we have of the magnetometer, the room up magnetometer, to the surface. That is about the spatial scale. We can also say something about the magnetization. This does not exclude that on even smaller scales, millimeter or submillimeter scales, we have magnetized grains. And there are instruments on board Rosetta where we later might be able also to infer information about that magnetization. But on this critical scale of about a meter, which is an interesting scale because there we have lots of questions concerning their formation, we think we can exclude the importance of magnetic forces.
Right, because yeah, I mean, just going back to the science papers earlier in the year, there was a lot of talk about these goosebumps and this preferred scale on 67P, that these were the planetesimals, these were the fundamental building blocks of that scale, that sort of 1 to 3 meter size of objects that came together to form 67P. So, I mean, are you thinking in that kind of arena?
Yeah, this is a spatial scale where we, right, as I said, we can, and there we can, we just think we can exclude the importance of, yeah, magnetic forces.
And the meter scale is a very conservative assumption. So we calculated with a distance of the sensor of about 1 meter, but it could be much, much closer if we see the orientation of the lander here. We know that maybe 1 foot will be has no contact with the comets, and we need a 3rd foot, and that 3rd foot could be, for instance, the boom of the ROMAP instrument, which we have some other indication with that. In that case, we are very close in the centimeter, maybe in the 10 centimeter scale. But of course, we have to, for science paper, we have to assume conservative assumption, and therefore we limited our suggestion to 1 meter scales only.
So on the micrometer scale, there might be magnetized dust particles. But if you have many of them, you need a guide field to orient them, to align them to larger structures, meter size or so. And this is what I think we can exclude from our measurements. This does not mean that on the micrometer scale there is not magnetization. But therefore we need different observations.
Right, okay. And then I've got a couple of questions, one for Matt, one for Stefan. The one for Matt, I mean, is this it now until after perihelion? We can't go any much closer to the comet because Rosetta will just throw a fit.
Well, it doesn't throw a fit. It behaves itself. It's designed to do this. It's just we are at about 100 kilometres. We're stepping closer. So we'll get to a point where we're trying to find how close we can get, basically. And that I couldn't give you an answer on what that number is at the moment. That's the situation we're in, is to step a bit closer and a bit closer week by week, and then see what the situation is. And then the transition to this terminator orbit as well will be interesting, because there may be particle dynamics involved in making more dust be there than on the day side, for instance. So we have to see what the environment is. It's really, in some sense, the whole orbiter now is an experiment rather than the separate sub-instruments.
But in a sense, as you move towards perihelion, the police cordon must surely be moving.
Yeah, out. This is what we are thinking. But again, we have to wait until we've done a few of these legs to get a feel for, again, how the spacecraft is going to behave. But this could be one option, is that, yeah, we are a significant standoff distance. But I'll be discussing with the mission manager and also the people at ESOC what exactly we can do in case this is the situation. Basically try as best we can to get the best science out, given the comet that we have and the spacecraft.
And then, Stefan, you mentioned the temperature. This minus 45 Celsius. Is that a flaw? I mean, if you go below that, that really causes problems for the onboard electronics.
Yeah, the lander is designed in a way that if it's below, the power input from the solar generator would be used for heating and not for booting the computer.
Right. So, I mean, do you have concerns about the temperature where it is?
Well, if the situation is bad, like if we also had some ceiling, which we do not know because we don't have a camera looking upwards, the shadowing effect may be bad. I mean, there is a large range of uncertainty, but if it's on the bad side of this uncertainty, it could well be that we stay cold, yeah.
And in the red ellipse images, what's the size of the red ellipse?
The red ellipse is larger than what we really believe. it's a bit symbolic. The red ellipse was something like 300 times 50 meters, but our belief is much better in terms of the localization. It's rather in the range of 30 times 50 meters or something like that.
Kai Orban for the Deutschland from Germany. Just a quick addition to the previous question to Stefan Ulametz. So, what parts of Philae are most likely to still work when the lander got very very cold, and which ones are more likely not to work anymore when it wakes up?
I think that's difficult to say which one would. The magnetometer would work perfectly. Now, of course, the most important part is that the power control system and the central computer, which is the brain of the lander, would work. There is no strong reason why they should not be working anymore if the power is sufficient and the temperature is sufficient, although in this period of hibernation we have faced, or the units have faced, temperatures below the qualification level. So if the central computer, which is redundant, or at least one side, and the power control system and the communication system are working, then I would say the rest, including the instruments, should be working as well. One can never rule out that some instrument is not operational anymore because everything gets very cold, but in principle everything should work. That includes the mechanisms, like having another attempt of drilling.
I have another question. This is from Alexander Telishev from RIA Novosti Newswire. In January, there was a paper about a thick layer of dust, that's 67P, will shed when it approaches the sun. Did it happen, and did the instruments of Rosetta detect any changes on the surface in terms of chemical or mineral composition, reflectivity, and so on?
We've started to see an evolution on the surface, but it's a very gradual one. So there are signs of maybe some of the subsurface showing through. So we have indications that we're seeing surface ice, and some of that was also detected by the lander when it landed, the fact that there was this very hard subsurface. It may be that we're seeing signs of that from the orbiter now on the global sense. But it matches very well with the level of emission of volatiles that we were observing from other measurements that feed the coma. The amount of the surface that you need to have that visible material matches up very well. So, and we're starting to see that with the increase in activity. So it appears to be that that's happening. But it's ongoing.
This is for German radio. What do you think will be the impact of the recently observed navigation glitches for Rosetta's science observations?
In the near term, we've lost some of the close observations. One thing we were planning to do was a lot more of these close flybys, but at the moment they're deemed to be not possible. So we lose that aspect in the near term. And as I said before to the previous question, we are looking at what can be done to mitigate this. But we've come back in online and we've started to make scientific observations at a limited sense that we have some pointing that we can't do. It'll become clearer in the next months exactly what we can do and what we can achieve in the near term. As was alluded to, we're going through perihelion, which is the most active, the time when we were expecting not to get that close to the comet in the first place. So this is compounding our situation.
And this is from Leo Enright from Irish TV. How big a concern are the temperatures that must be lower than expected at the final landing site? So what instruments are more at risk, and is the comms package very temperature sensitive?
Well, as I said before, none of the units within the so-called warm compartment of the lander was qualified for these low temperatures, but none of them is particularly sensitive. That includes also the communications unit. So a problem one may face with these low temperatures is some thermal stresses on the electronics boards, and they may damage soldering points. This is a danger we have to live with, but there is none of the instruments particularly more sensitive to these temperatures. All the instruments and mechanisms which are outside the warm compartment of the lander, like on the balcony or so, they are all qualified also for very low temperatures, because we were expecting those to get cold even if we had landed on the planned landing site.
Thank you very much for your time. I'm afraid we don't have time for more questions.
That from the European Geosciences Union in Vienna, Austria, last Wednesday. Now, do you remember last Wednesday we played the woodpecker song? That's the woodpecker sounds from Rosetta. Well, here's another which uses that sound. It's by Mr. Fogg and it's called Don't Let the Light Go Out.
The high wall peering through your house. There's no comfort in darkness.
This has been The Space Show. I'm Andrew Rennie. Nick Black's coming up next with Purple Haze. We'll be back next Wednesday at 7:00.